This is a really specific scenario. It's an ice runway with a cirrus, and the number of listeners who will be in that situation is vanishingly close to zero, I have a feeling. However, the bigger picture here is this balance of risk-reward for an action that you're going to have to make a split-second decision on. On one side of the camp, we say, when in doubt, go around. Just go around. We do it all the time. If there's any question about a landing, go around. And that's probably the instinct here. Power up and get out of here. But perhaps this situation's more akin to a turnback with an engine failure, right? Going around on this ice runway situation has a decent likelihood of success, but there's a potential for catastrophic results if it really goes wrong. Whereas riding it out has a high likelihood of aircraft damage, almost a certainty, and maybe even total loss of the airplane, but a really, really low chance of injury to anyone. So, Kevin, what do you say to somebody saying you're just trying to save an airplane here and that even a tiny risk of catastrophe isn't worth it just to save the Cirrus?
The situation that we have ourselves in is you're in a spot where you are losing control of the aircraft on the runway. And that is a place where there's a very real number of GA airplane accidents. And so it's not without any thought that I would say that I want to get control of the airplane the best way that I can. And I think that putting the power in and going around is a very quick and I think safe path to getting the airplane back under control and pointed in the direction I want to and climbing away from the runway. And I'm not going to pretend that it's without risk, but I do think that the risk is very, very small. And I don't even think that it's necessarily that much more risk than we might have in a lot of other situations flying an airplane.
One of the things that you said, Kevin, that I really appreciated was that you had a caveat on your choice, which is if you powered up and the plane didn't straighten out right away, you would power back, pull the mixture, and call it. Staying with you for just a moment, that opportunity to bail out, as it were, to change your mind, how important a factor is that in making this decision, that you know you can kind of test it? You've got a wide open space, and you're going to know pretty much right away whether this is going to work or not.
Well, that's not even really unique to this situation. I think that applies to everything else where if you found yourself in a hole that you're digging, stop digging sometimes, right? And maybe that's the way you get yourself out of the situation is to stop digging. That is, I think, one way to do that in this scenario. It would be to chop the throttle and the mixture, by the way, and ride it out and hope for the best.
So, Kevin, you're in camp, go around, but you always could bail out. Steve, you also chose choice four. What would you add to Kevin's analysis of that situation there? How important is it to be able to bail out? And what's your thinking that that's really the best option here?
I like thinking about the bailout. You're going to know pretty much immediately. Once you get the thrust and the air going over the tail, whether that's going to happen. A thing you worry about is left-turning tendency of the aircraft. And you are, I mean, even more so because you're on ice. You really, anything you learn flying off grass, pavement, or anything other than ice might or might not be applicable. You're going to be dealing primarily with torque, maybe with slipstream, less so with P factor, less so with gyroscopic precession with respect to the prop. The thing I know for sure is two and three really aren't much of an option because you're a test pilot, really, in that regime. You need to commit one way or the other. I'm going to ride it out or I'm going to go. It seems to me, And you make a really good point about, am I taking on some additional risk of bodily injury just to save an airframe? There is an extent to which we have to be at least audacious enough to walk out onto the ramp and commit aviation in the first place. I think that that risk is more than worth it, even if it's only to save an airframe and potentially take on some additional risk of bodily injury associated with going off the end or of encountering circumstances that you didn't expect. Now dealing with left-turning tendency and other stuff where you essentially have no traction and, you know, you're effectively in the air mass. You might as well be, except for flight dynamics that would be in place with P-factor, where you'd have an increased angle of attack of the prop in rotation. So long story short, I think getting the heck out of there, I think it plays into what we're all conditioned to. As a pilot, you know, this landing is not going well. Hell, this approach is not going well. It's not stabilized. Let's get out of here. I think makes sense. It's a thing we've all done before, whether with a ballooned or porpoising landing. It's a thing we're familiar with in terms of how to do that with all the other factors available. I think the small risk of running into that 4-foot snowbank at the end or possibly you power up and the airplane on ice, it's a cirrus, does something you don't expect, and you end up in that 2-foot snowbank on the side at a high power setting, I think are risks worthy of taking. You just need to be able to be spring-loaded to the airplane turns further to left, you catch a gust, the torque effect does way more in terms of turning you left than you thought it was going to. You've got to be in a position to be able to, okay, now throttle idle, mixture idle, potentially even mags off to get that prop stopped as soon as you can. I think it's more than worth it to power up and get the heck out of that situation.
So staying with team go around, you know, Steve, you're saying you're going for it full power or you're going for it no power, no pansy power changes. But Paul, your choice three. What's your rationale for the partial power to get rudder authority and then the full power when you're running out of runway?
I have a method to my madness here, and it's based on actual facts. Kevin, you said that this is a low percentage of GA accidents in this scenario, but it's actually a high percentage of cirrus accidents. And I know this because when I was digging into cirrus accidents, I found, I guess what I would call a characteristic accident. And I think I might have found about a half a dozen of them, and they were all the same. They were go-round accidents in which the pilot firewalled the throttle, got slow on the go-round, the torque effects took over, rolled the airplane to the left, and all of them have similar pictures. There's burned wreckage to the left side of the departure end of the runway. It's rather shocking to see these things. I won't say it's common, but it's happened a number of times. So my thinking in this is that if you're on this ice runway and you're looking at that berm, that snow berm coming, and you have this idea that I'm going to shove the throttle all the way forward to get the hell out of here, that is going to aggravate that situation. So the difference between three and four for me is about a second and a half. So I'm going to bring that power in slowly and step it, get the rudder in so that I'm aligned, and then bring the rest of it in smoothly. And I'm going to be very careful about trying to lift the airplane off too soon and get the nose too high to climb over a 4-foot obstacle. And then that's why earlier in our briefing, I asked about there's a hill there beyond there, but you have to turn a little bit to the left to get Clear Lake beyond. But you may be looking at that hill and think, geez, I got to climb over this thing, and it's right there. And that's the classic accident scenario that I just described, where the pilot gets too aggressive on the go-around, gets slow. Now, Cirrus has a lot of power and torque, big three-bladed prop, and the next thing you know, it's rolled and he's lost control. So that's why I would do it gingerly. And I think the difference in getting off that runway between right now and a second and a half is not going to affect the outcome.
Kevin, sounded like you wanted to make a response to that.
Sure. I did touch on that a little bit in my response, was that I definitely would advocate against just absolutely punching it to the firewall to add power to go around. and absolutely for the reasons that you're talking about. And so that's why I would advocate for smoothly going to full power. And by that, I mean, I'm not going to hesitate at half throttle. I'm not going to advance it, the throttle to half, let it sit there for a second, let the rudder settle into where I want it to be, and then go full throttle. I'm going directly to full throttle, but like I said, it probably would take a second or two, maybe a couple, 2-3 seconds to go from fully aft to full forward power.
I want to go over to Team Ride It Out, and I'm going to completely arbitrarily pick someone who probably has the most experience with contaminated runways around here. I'm going to guess that that's you, David, being from the Great White North up there. What's your rationale for why it's important at this point to ride it out? You got 1,500 feet of runway. You've got more than 100% power available to you. You're still moving. It's 100 feet wide, and you just have to get just basically 4 feet into the air before you can smooth it out and go.
Actually, ironically, I probably have the least recent experience because I live in the rainy West Coast, but I did learn to fly in Montreal and flew back east. I'd like to start with a more general comment. I don't think this really has, at the end of the day, anything to do with the ice runway. The real question is it wise to do a low-speed go-round? So that was really where I started at my thinking. So you have lost control. The Y doesn't really matter. The airspeed's down to half of your liftoff speed and decreasing, and you're halfway down the runway. I would say for most pilots, there is no go-around option at this point. By landing and rolling out, you've decided to land. The go-around option happens before the wheels touch. And so if you haven't made that decision, then I would argue you've already decided you're landing. And if you look at the accident stats, as Paul brought out, in general, rejected landings halfway down the runway often end badly in all sorts of situations. So I think the takeaway here is, yes, you can go around. And I think some, cogent and important comments were made about how to do it. But you've already made a decision, in my view, when you're rolling out. And I think you it's almost like a V1. I think there's almost no circumstances where powering up well down the runway at low airspeed is a good idea. And particularly not a good idea with all the factors working against you. As a glider, for the glider guys, of course, you touch down at quite low airspeeds. And so I have a video that a fellow took of me this summer where I took off with the wind on the runway and came back with 20 knots at 90 degrees. And so I was flying down final with 45 degrees of crab angle. And it took a huge turn to align the glider with the runway. And then I had to smack it on. And even in that few brief seconds, I wasn't able to hold the downwind wing up. So the wing, the airplane tilted over a bit. So I think one of the things that people, I would suggest, have maybe not put enough thought into is you're effectively airborne on an ice runway, right? The vectors all are as if you were in the air. And so I don't share the optimism that you could, in fact, get enough rudder control fast enough to stop not just being blown down on the downwind side of the runway.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. And I kind of want to challenge one thing you said in there, though, in that you don't have the option to go around. It's almost like, you've committed to it. I feel like this is sort of analogous to going around from a circling approach. You've gone past the point of the obvious missed approach point. Okay, it's time to go around before I've landed. And then something went wrong after that point. And now you've got kind of a non-standard way to deal with going around and flying a missed approach. Here, it's a non-standard go-around. And when David was talking about that, I noticed you, Wally, going, you had a look on your face like, I don't know if I buy that you can't really go around once you're rolling out, that's not such a black and white thing.
I certainly agree with what he said, but I think there was just lots of clues for this pilot to go around before he touched down, which would have been something he knows how to do. I'd like to first look at his motivation to land there. He says he wants to land there just to see what it's like. So it's not a life or death matter here. he assumed that crosswind was going to be funneling down the valley, which chances are it would have as he approached the airport. But he obviously had a crab on final because he had to put the wing down as he got into the flare. And I think that crab on final should have told him that there's probably that crosswind is still there. It didn't come down the valley like he'd like it to. Further, I've landed on ice a lot of times because I learned to fly in Minnesota. And there's lots of different kinds of ice. There's some ice with an inch of snow on it. This ice apparently was black ice. That's breaking action nil. So let's look at this guy's plan. He's going to a place to land where he knows breaking action is nil. Most of us wouldn't land at an airport if we knew that. Secondly, he's just going there to see what it's like. Thirdly, he suspects a bit of a crosswind, and sure enough, he's got some clues that tell him. And so I think there was lots of things that would have said to me, hopefully, I'm going to go around before I get on that ice and get in trouble. Now, the question here is, what do you do now that you're on the ice? And my answer was to ride it out, just because if we've got approximately 35 knots of airspeed, we've got a little headwind, so we're maybe under 30 knots of ground speed, and yeah, we might damage the airplane. And hopefully we checked our exclusions in our insurance policy before we took off about landing on ice runways. Maybe that'll make a difference in my decision. But I think I just prefer to go off that side at 20 knots or so and deal with the damage later.
Makes sense to me. And, you know, Wally, you had talked about you've landed on lots of ice before and there's different kind of ice. And that's one of the things I was hoping to sort of take away from this scenario for people is this whole idea of contaminated runways in general. Right. And what are some things for ice in general that you look at for, you know, snow-covered, ice-covered runways when you were flying back then or in your flying since then? You're in a warmer climb now, but.
Well, we you know, sometimes we would be blessed with a very early hard freeze where I lived, and you'd get a nice black ice all over the lake with absolutely no snow. When the snow starts to come, then you have to be concerned about snow drifts and how deep the snow really is. And you can't tell that by flying over the lake, or it's up, you know, it'd be very hard to do that. So you need to have you need a reconnoiter with somebody on the ground about that to stay away from the drifts. And in a case with a runway like this, where they're probably plowing it with plows, I don't know, Kevin said maybe they used a Zamboni, which would slick it up pretty good. But if they're using plows, usually it's kind of rough and broken up, and typically you can get some breaking with that. But here you've decided to land an airplane that relies entirely on braking for directional control once it gets slower. And you've got a situation with that black ice that you know you're not going to have any braking control. So I think this was pretty predictable.
John, I want to give you an opportunity to chime in here as part of Camp Ride It Out. Are there any other factors in that decision that you feel haven't been addressed in it's not worth it to try and go around?
Yeah, so I think if you back up to the moment of panic here, when you're sliding sideways, you've already got a boot full of right rudder in and nothing's happening. So if you bring up the power and to Paul's point about the torque rolls in Cirrus, there was a fatal accident literally right in front of my house, which was the exact same thing. It was a go around from probably 10 feet off the runway, and it just rolled upside down, crashed into trees right next to the runway right here. So especially the airplane's light, you're only 2,900 pounds. You've got the 310 horsepower engine out there. It's going to be tough to keep it going straight with that kind of power. And you're pointed 25 degrees at the upwind side of the runway, already sliding. So the airplane's only going to go left. It's going to be very difficult to get it to go right. And you're rapidly approaching the far end of the runway. I've landed at Alton Bay a bunch of times, same, you know, and generally it's not as dramatic as you think. It's actually pretty easy. And, you know, in a 172, I could land and turn off at that midfield taxiway pretty consistently with any kind of wind. But my concern with the go-around would be if I initiated the go-around, and once you do that, you're committed, would be clipping that upwind snowbank with a prop or a wheel or wingtip or something like that. Now you're airborne with a damaged airplane, and you're going to wind up putting it back on the lake further down into a snowdrift. Those side berms, snow berms, can be 4 feet or so easily. You know, the departure end is usually pushed up quite a bit, but the left side or the upwind side can get pretty high. And there's people out there too. There's always people on snowmobiles, and there's those ice fishing shacks that you would be headed for as you're applying full power. So all of that tells me pull the mixture and call the insurance company.
So there are two things in there that you said. I want to address both of them, but let's start with the people on the side of the runway.
Yep.
You're factoring that into your decision here. How big a factor is that for you? Because, I mean, that's true of lots of situations. I mean, take a fly-in, any kind of fly-in, right? It's not just this kind of ice runway that's this big attraction. There are going to be people nearby the runway, and, you know, you may end up over where they are to begin with.
Honestly, at that point, I don't think I'd be thinking about it. It's the after analysis. But at that point, you're just like, let's just get this thing stopped, because going around is not going to be pretty.
You know, Paul, we've talked about this sometimes about responsibility to people on the ground, particularly in like an engine out scenario or something, say like landing on a beach and things like that. I know we've talked about that in the past. Did the people around in the bob houses, the ice fishing and such, you can kind of see them in the picture there, does that factor into your planning at all? And if you felt the airplane going in that direction, is there anything you're going to do differently than if it was moving in a different direction?
Not,
you're shaking your head. No, it's just not really in your picture.
I'm not going to be the guy who would sacrifice himself crashing into trees to save the kids in the schoolyard. I mean, well, maybe that's an unfortunate analogy, but I look at it as informed consent. If you're out there and you're standing beside the runway watching the airplanes land, then you've accepted a risk. You might not understand it. You might not fully realize what could go wrong, but you've done it. And I don't think the pilot is under any compunctions whatsoever to damage himself or damage his airplane just to avoid you. And that's just, to me, that's the way it is. And I look at the same thing on cars on highways. You know, when you land an airplane on a highway, yeah, there's a risk. One of those risks is an airplane could come down and bounce off the roof.
That's what everybody on the highway is thinking about when they're out driving.
That's life in an industrial society, right? So, no. I mean, I think it's fair to expect you to do what you can, but not without pranging yourself.
Let's look a little bit at planning here. Wally, we brought up some interesting points about, you know, where this flight went wrong. And I sit with you in that somewhere on the downwind when he saw the Cessna crabbing on final and then touching down crabbed and still going straight on the runway. Like, that was probably the place where you realized, you know, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. But what about the choice of bringing a Cirrus into something like this? I mean, granted, it's got nose wheel steering, but, you know, the Cirrus comes from Duluth, Minnesota, and I hear that they have snow and ice up there occasionally. So one would think that this would still be something that was controllable on a contaminated runway. Maybe I'll go to you, Kevin. You know, you said you would never take an airplane without nose wheel steering in there. Do you really think it was completely irresponsible to take that plane in, or it was really just for these conditions?
No, I wouldn't do it under at landing at Alton Bay. A more ideal situation would be little to no wind and ice that has texture to it. And in those situations, it's probably you could get away with it, but still I'm not doing it in a Cirrus or an airplane without nose wheel steering. And I'm thinking you're probably asking about a situation that I had when I was flying a charter flight, or I had planned to fly a charter flight in a Cirrus. And the airport that I was to depart, I was departing empty to reposition to pick up my charter passengers. And the airport manager did a, I think, negligent job of reporting the conditions of the airport. And the ice on the ramp and on the runway was such that in taxiing out, I, on three different occasions, had to shut down the engine, get out, push down on the tail, swing the nose in a different direction, get back in the airplane, and press on. I wound up choosing to not depart from that airport because of the icy conditions there, but it wasn't until after I had already been out on the ramp and on the runway in the icy conditions before I said, no, sorry, this trip is not happening.
Right. And that was probably a really good example of getting the clues, the little hints along the way that maybe this wasn't such a good idea. You know, similar ones might be if you can't run up because the airplane is just sliding along with its wheels locked, you know, that's also probably a good indication. Because one thing I think about this is, how would you depart this airport? Let's suppose you did ride it out and everything was fine. And so you get out, you go get yourself some hot chocolate, you come back, and now you're going to put your Cirrus at the end of the runway. How are you even going to be able to power up and get out of the airport if you're having that much trouble with directional control until you really get going?
The towering up part would not be a problem. I think you could power up just fine and dandy, but the keeping it pointed down the runway part, not doable.
Wally.
Jeff, back to your question. Sure. You know, Cirrus is a great airplane, but they're not designed for off-road work, you know, generally. So I think, you know, our pilot recognized that the length was probably going to be okay, but he, our scenario pilot, also needed to recognize that there was a lot going against him doing this in a Cirrus, which is not the best airplane to take to Halton Bay. And as he began to see some of these other things, like the crosswind and the black ice showing up, that maybe that would have been some good clues that maybe he should do this on a different day.
You know, let's just talk a little bit about the distance, which you just brought up there. 3,100 feet of runway this particular day, because that's how much they were able to plow it out to, is really ample for a Cirrus under normal conditions. This pilot regularly landed at a runway of approximately equal length without braking. But was that really a sufficient amount of runway to plan for this plane? There is an AC giving some guidance on landing distance here, and it says that when the braking action is poor, you're supposed to have increase a factor, they say 5.1. I don't know where they get that number from. It's an awfully exact number. You know, I live in Maine, and Ryan, who's often here, lives in Wisconsin. David, you might be flying back over in Montreal. How do you make a reasonable adjustment for what might be a contaminated runway? Because 5.1 seems a little excessive. Pretty much every runway is going to be too short all of a sudden.
I think back in my airline days, we had a procedure where we added 10% for a contaminated runway. That's not very much. But remember, we had airplanes with thrust reversers. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that black ice, the braking was just virtually nil there. As you pointed out, I don't know how you could do a run-up. Certainly, taxiing was going to be a real challenge if there was any wind. So I just think it was a bad idea for this kind of an airplane on that day.
Paul?
Yeah, I would agree with Wally. I think there's no margin there. And you're doing this just to see what it's like. So really not a good imperative there to take that kind of risk. The payoff is not there. As far as other contaminated runways, in my experience, and I flew for 20 years in New England, they're all long runways. You know, I landed at Bridgeport once on a 5,000-foot runway with little icebergs blowing across the runway and the crosswind. It was not a problem. We just rolled out. Hardly had to use the brakes at all, but that's not the case here. I think 3,100 feet, you said, is ample for a Cirrus, but I wouldn't call it generous. You got to be on your numbers, and you got to have the touchdown point exactly right. Otherwise, you don't have the margin.
And this pilot did put the plane down exactly where they said it was going to be, and it actually went wrong after that, which is really one of the challenges here. John, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, so one of the reasons of going there, obviously, is to get that. They give you a really nice certificate suitable for framing, saying that you've landed on the ice runway. So that may be sufficient for some people. But the departure is actually, it's very much like a seaplane. You're doing a rolling mag check. You know, you start at the end of the runway, bring the power up to 1,800 or something, quick mag check, bring the power in and go. So, you know, that's really not that much of a big deal, the departure. It's more getting stopped.
Kevin.
One of the things we're talking about is that the pilot wants to come and check it out and to see what it's like. That part of it, I don't think is unique to Halton Bay, but it is certainly a big part of the reason that a lot of people fly into Halton Bay. Part of the advice that I always give to people when they talk about flying into Halton Bay is to bring somebody that has been there before and has some experience and can point out things like, hey, the crab angle, the color of the ice, all these different things that are unique to flying into something like Alton Bay. There's plenty of other scenarios flying. It could be flying through a widespread warm front, IMC and rain and that kind of stuff, and you haven't done that before. Go do that with somebody that's done it. Or mountain flying. Go if you're going to fly in the mountains and see what that's all about. Or backcountry. Or, you know, the list goes on and on. But if you're going to do something that's outside of your normal, if you can bring somebody that's been there, done that, then do that. And these people are around and available, so there's no reason not to.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And that person doesn't need to be an instructor necessarily, as long as you have clear division of responsibility in the airplane itself and you know who's doing what and who's pilot in command. Sometimes you can't find a local instructor who's an expert, but you might have somebody who's just got lots of personal experience. Ideally, go with them in their plane if you're willing, with something they know really well. David.
A couple of points. One is you asked about how do you how do you figure out for contaminated runways? And I think for light aircraft, there's a huge difference between nil and everything else. If you get a little bit of braking with a lighter airplane, you're going to stop. So I tell my students, you know, if in doubt, just double the distance from the POH. And 99.8% of the time, that's going to work fine. But if you know the runway braking action is nil, then, you know, you have no idea what's going to happen and why you're there. The other thing that's important is the AC talks about factored landing distance, adding a factor of 5, but it also has a note about directional control is likely significantly reduced. So it should be zero surprise here that he's going to have trouble keeping straight, which is obviously the issue here. Finally, a last little quick item is Inuit have 15 words for snow. And so when you talk about the snowbank, you know, it's very unlikely it's that light puffy powder. It's probably cement. So if you snag a wingtip on it, it would be just like, you know, sticking it into earth, and the airplane will cartwheel and the outcome will be very, very bad. So I think you have to consider it as a solid obstacle. And so hitting it at speed and power is not going to end well.
Yeah, anyone who's done skiing in New England knows that our snow is basically just a block of ice. That's what we do around here. It'll stop you really well, but it'll definitely do some damage on the way. John?
So just an Alton Bay anecdote. One of the craziest things I ever saw there was a guy in, I think it was like a J3 cub or something, no electrical system. Of course, this is in January, you know, it's like 4 degrees outside. Mm-hmm. So he's wearing the full-on snowmobile suit with boots, okay? And he's a big guy. He's probably, you know, 240, 250, something like that. He gets out and he had a hand prop it on the ice in a snowmobile suit.
What could possibly go wrong?
I mean, I just have this vision of like falling down. You know, under the prop as it's spinning.
And he managed, you know. I mean, he held on to the strut.
Oh, great. So now I have a vision of him holding the strut, the engine running, and it's just dragging
down. You do it from behind the prop.
Right,
and that comes in front.
Which
you
behind,
do it from behind the prop.
Behind.
Yeah.
But it's gonna slide along.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He's going to be standing there holding the strut with the engine running, pulling him across the ice.
And trying just to get, like boots trying and to all. Get his butt back into the cub, you know, and his feet around and everything. And it was a continuous movement. He did it really well, and it just took off, you know.
The bigger challenge is getting your feet and boots into the rudders.
Yeah,
I can barely do it with tennis shoes on.
Right.
Yeah, that's impressive. You know, what's funny is part of the scenario was actually generated from an experience of mine. It was in a 172. It wasn't a Cirrus. And ironically, I chose option 2. I powered up just enough to keep myself sliding down the runway sideways, not hitting either side until the plane finally came to a stop on its own and then taxied off and around. And maybe that was because I'd run into similar situations. I had landed a Mooney once and started hydroplaning and slid sideways down the runway with just enough power to stop it. And once managed not to ground loop in a Citabria by sliding sideways on a really, really wet grass. I'm still not quite sure how that worked out. But it did. And so I suppose there was a little bit of bias in that direction when something similar happened at Alton Bay. But I think the real takeaway from all that is that there is a point early in any of those landings when you really were getting the clues. And in all three of those situations with myself, I had clues early on that it was a bad idea and should have aborted beforehand. And I probably should have just wrote it out in all of those situations and it would have been fine. Instead, I did something kind of in between and got lucky. But after listening to this whole discussion and after really thinking about it, either you're going to go around and you're going to commit to it, or you're going to ride it out, pull the mixture, stop the engine if you can, and just take your lumps, because that's going to be the lower risk thing, and live to fly another day.